If you have your Bible here with you today, if you could turn in the Gospel of John, chapter 11. As many of you know, we started out when we launched Hope Church, we started out in this Gospel of John, and we've been looking at this sermon series called Come and See. And the reason why it's called Come and See, it's because we've invited you to come and witness who this Jesus is. And John is basically a revelation of who Jesus is. And so today we're going to look at a passage that actually Joseph Longarino preached on last week. He did a fantastic job preaching on the topic of Jesus and trusting him, even when we don't know what the future holds, even when we think that he's missed it. And so today we're going to take a little bit of a different angle here at John chapter 11. So I'm going to invite you to turn your Bibles to it. The title of today's sermon is A Weeping Messiah. The shortest verse in the Bible is what we're really going to narrow in on. And that is for later, that picture there. And so here we go. Here is A Weeping Messiah, John chapter 11. I'm going to flash the passage up for us here, and we're going to read together. You can follow along or you could read on your own from John chapter 11. Here we go. So starting in verse 1, here we go. Now a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sister sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Now, last week, Joseph talked about how Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, they already had a relationship with Jesus. In fact, Lazarus is called the one who Jesus loved. So we already know that Jesus already has a personal relationship with these folks. It's not like he's some removed person. He actually knows and loves Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. So that's why when the invitation for Jesus to come when Lazarus is sick is there, they're basically saying, "Jesus, the one you love, your friend, the one you care about, is sick." When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death." Now he's talking to some of his disciples. "No, it's for God's glory so that God's Son may be glorified through it." So in other words, what Jesus is saying is, listen, I know that Lazarus is sick right now, but something spectacular is going to happen where God's glory is going to be revealed. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Again, it's said again. To emphasize, these are not folks that Jesus just does not think about or care about. It's people that he loves. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. All right, that's interesting, Jesus. And then he said to his disciples, "Let us go back to Judea," which is near Bethany, where he was going to go back to see this family. "But Rabbi," the disciples said, "a short while ago, the Jews there tried to stone you. And yet you are going back." What are they referring to? In chapter 10, it was the same deal, right? Jesus was giving this great teaching on the great shepherd, that God is a God who knows your name and you follow his voice. And the Jews were so upset about it, they wanted to stone him. So they left. And so now the disciples are kind of freaking out a little bit. They're like, "Wait a minute, Jesus, you're talking about going back to the very place where people wanted to stone you." And Jesus is like, "Yep. That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm going to this family that I love." After he said this, he went on to tell them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I'm going there to wake him up." Now you can understand the disciples are a little bit confused, right? Because his disciples replied, "Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better." That's what happens when people sleep. They sleep and then they wake up. Jesus had been speaking of his death, but his disciples thought he meant natural sleep. So in other words, Jesus already knows that Lazarus has actually died. So then he told them plainly, he told his disciples, "Listen, Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I am glad I was not there so that you may believe, because something's about to go down." Hello, somebody, right? I mean, you see what's happening. He's basically foreshadowing, "Listen, I know what's going to happen. He's dead, but something's about to go down. So that you may believe, but let us go to him." Then Thomas, who is one of the disciples, also called Didymus, said to the rest of the disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him," right? So because the disciples are like, "Okay, I guess we're going back to Judea. We're going to get stoned along with Jesus here." And Jesus is like, "No, you don't understand. Something's about to go down." Now, when he arrives in Bethany, what happens? If we can go to the next slide. On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. And remember, Joseph talked about when someone had been in the tomb for 4 days, that means basically they were dead. It's not like they were sleeping or maybe they were sick and we just misinterpreted his heartbeat or something. He was dead. He was embalmed. He was in the tomb. Now, Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him, but Mary stayed at home. Lord, Martha said to Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Jesus, I know that you have miraculous powers. I know that you've opened the eyes of the blind. I know that you've taught with great authority. I know that you could probably resurrect the dead, but I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Whew. Awesome. Martha answered, I know he will rise again in the resurrection in the last day. Of course, I know that. You've talked about that before and I've read about it. Jesus said to her, no, you don't understand. I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this, Martha? Yes, Lord, she replied. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into the world. After she had said this, she went back and called her sister Mary aside. The teacher is here, she said, and is asking for you. When Mary heard this, she got up quickly and went to meet him. Now, Jesus had not yet entered the village, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who had been with Mary in the house, comforting her, noticed how quickly she got up and went out, they followed her, supposing she was going to the tomb to mourn there. So Mary hears about it. She goes with this big crowd to go and meet Jesus. When Mary reached the place where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet and said, Lord, if you had been here. Notice it's the same question that Martha says, the same statement. My brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her weeping, he sees his good friend in a pool of tears. And the Jews who had come along with her also weeping. So there's just, people are weeping and weeping. He was deeply moved in spirit and troubled. Where have you laid him? He asked. Come and see, Lord, they replied. And here's the verse 35. Jesus wept. The easiest verse in the Bible to memorize. Hallelujah. Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, see how he loved him. Look at how he's moved. Look at how he's weeping. But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man have kept this man from dying? Now, let me paint this picture for you again. Joseph, last week, he talked about what does it mean to trust in a God who can bring about resurrection even when it seems like it's impossible. And today we're gonna look at this whole story, and it's a real kind of a puzzling story in many respects, because here's what happened. Lazarus, Mary, and Martha, they were good friends of Jesus. It's very clear from the text. He's referred to as the one who Jesus loved. So it's kind of like popular reputation of Lazarus is that, oh, that guy is a good friend of Jesus. Of course Jesus is gonna come when Mary and Martha send word that Lazarus is sick. Now Jesus, knowing what's happening here, he already knows what's gonna happen to Lazarus. He already knows that it's not only that Lazarus is sick, but he knows that Lazarus has died, right? That's why when Jesus is talking to his disciples, this is what he says. When he heard this, Jesus said, this sickness will not end in death. I know that death is gonna be there, but it's not gonna end in death, because the end of this story is not gonna be Lazarus laying in a tomb. The end of this story is that God's glory, so that God's son may be glorified through it. At the end of what's gonna happen with Lazarus is that everyone is gonna point to Jesus and say, oh my goodness, that was awesome. That was God. That was something radical that happened. And God's son will get the glory. So can you imagine though? So Jesus already knows this. And even when his disciples are like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? He's sleeping, right? And Jesus is like, no, you don't understand. It's not that he's sleeping. He's actually dead. But you're gonna see something so radical that you're gonna see that if you believe in me, if you trust me, I can raise the dead. So Jesus is getting, he's amped up. I'm getting amped up about this, right? Because he's basically foreshadowing, this is what's gonna happen. I know the end score. You don't even have to watch the game. You could actually just come with me, because guess what? I'm gonna raise the dead. He already knows that his glory is gonna be revealed. Now, so can you imagine this? So he comes and he meets Martha, and Martha first, she's like, Lord, if you had only been here, if you had been here, I know you could have done something. And Jesus reminds her, I am the resurrection and the life. I want you to know that I'm gonna do something miraculous, and I can do something miraculous if you believe. And Martha's like, yeah, I know that the resurrection will come in the last day. But Jesus is like, listen, if you believe in me, I can raise the dead. She's like, well, yeah, I believe. And then her sister Mary, right? Martha says, hey, Mary, come. This is where Jesus is. Mary comes with this whole throng of people to Jesus. And they're wondering what Jesus was doing. And Mary also comes with the same statement that Martha made. Lord, if you had only been here. Have you ever been in a place where you've questioned God and you're just kind of like, man, if you had only done something, Jesus, if you had only worked, I know you could have done something. Have you ever felt like God was not on your timetable? And here Mary is, and Mary is just like, and it says that she just starts weeping. She's weeping and weeping in a pool of tears. And then those around her, this throng of people, they just start weeping too, weeping and weeping. Now, here's what's puzzling for me. Because in verse 35, what it says is this. It says that after Jesus witnesses all that's happening, he says, where have you laid him? Come and see, Lord, they replied. And then verse 35, Jesus wept. He's in this crowd of people all weeping, and Jesus begins to weep as well. Now, what's so puzzling about this is, why is Jesus weeping? He already knows he's going to resurrect Lazarus from the dead. He's already told his disciples, hey, listen, God's glory is going to be revealed. I'm going to do something awesome. Just watch this. You don't even have to watch the game, right? I already know the final score. The final score is Lazarus is out of the tomb. Come on, right? So he already knows this. But why in the world does Jesus weep? You know, honestly, if I were Jesus, I think something like this would have happened, right? If I knew that I was going to raise up Lazarus from the dead, right when I go and see Martha, and Martha's like, Lord, if you had only been here, I'd be like, I'm here now. I got this. She's like, okay, if you'd been here, and he's like, listen, I am the resurrection and the life. And then when he sees Mary and this throng of people who are weeping around him, I mean, for me, honestly, if I already knew this and my disciples were there and I came and I was walking, right, with a little bit of swag, right, I walked up, right, because I already know what's going to go down. I already know that I'm going to raise up Lazarus from the dead. And then I see Mary just weeping and weeping and weeping and everyone else weeping, and they're just all crying about this, right? I mean, honestly, part of me would just be like, hey, guys, stop crying. Watch. Lazarus, come forth. See, I told you, look, he's okay. Don't worry. Stop crying. You don't have to cry anymore. In fact, it's making me a little uncomfortable. I mean, right? Why? Jesus already knows the final score. Why in the world does he weep? He already knows the final score. Why? It's because he cares. And because he's human. And it's because Jesus reveals that loving someone, to love someone, means I'm willing to walk in their shoes. I'm willing to experience what it's like to be you. Jesus doesn't say to them, hey, stop crying. Will you kind of get over it? Lazarus, come forth. See, I told you. He already knows he's going to do that. No. What he wants to do in that moment is he cares so much for the people there. He loves them. And what it means to love them is he's willing to feel what they feel, to walk in their shoes. The theological term for this is incarnation. Can I hear you say incarnation? See, and this is what distinguishes the Christian God from any other religion or religious belief system. It's that there's a God who's so personal, who's so real, that he would take on flesh and he would actually walk in our shoes, that he would experience the things that we experience, that he would, even knowing that he could raise the dead, that he would weep with those who weep. Because guess what? That's what love does. To love someone means I'm willing to walk in your shoes. this word became flesh and dwelt among us. He actually walked among us. A lot of different religious systems or belief systems say that God is some impersonal philosophy or ideal that we could never attain. Although we should constantly shoot for that God, we should constantly shoot for that. Other religions say that God is so aloof. He's like this dictator above who is not personal. He created everything, but he's not personal to you. See, but here's the Christian God, and here's Jesus himself who comes and dwells with us. And he actually says, I want to walk in your shoes. I want to experience what you experience. I want to feel what you feel. Why? Because incarnation involves feeling what another person feels. Some of you are in a situation right now where you're like, God, you don't understand me. You don't know what I'm going through. I can't believe you haven't shown up for me. And here's Jesus, who's actually revealing himself as a God who is not distant and impersonal and ignoring you, but a God who knows the final outcome and a God who takes the time to weep, to let you know that he knows exactly what you're experiencing, exactly what you're going through. Maybe it's a broken relationship and you're just like, no one understands. I want you to know that there's a God in heaven who knows exactly what you're going through. Maybe you've been looking for a job for a long time and there's a God in heaven who knows exactly what you're going through. Maybe you're just anxious about the future. You don't know what the future holds with your family, with your kids. And there's a God who knows what you feel, is feeling what you feel, and a God who's present with you. If you'll recognize it. Loving someone means feeling what another person feels. You know, my brother-in-law, he's actually a graduate of business school. He was an investment banker before, and then he went into working in some nonprofits, and then he went off to business school. And I'm only mentioning this because I'm very proud of my brother-in-law, but he went to business school. He went to a top three business school in the country. It's a very famous one. It's called Stanford University Business School. And it was funny because when he was about to graduate, and I only mentioned that he went to that business school because of what he told me when he was graduating. He said, you know, I spent a lot of money invested in going to business school for 2 years, living there, relocating there to Northern California. And he said, when really all I learned after 2 years of business school was how to say six words. He said, I'm telling you, everything sums up into these six words. Every single class that I went to kind of sums up into these six words. And I was like, what are those six words? And he said, that is interesting. Tell me more. He said, I learned to say, that is interesting. Tell me more. He said, at all the business functions that he would go to, he learned to say, you know, that's interesting. Tell me more. In every class, when they talked about different interpersonal relationship skills, he said, what he learned how to say was, oh, you know, that is so interesting. Tell me more. And then he said, what he learned was after you actually say those words and you invite people to share a little bit more of their story, when you actually invite them to share so that you can walk in their shoes, they actually feel cared for and they feel loved, and then you can make a lot of money together. That's interesting. Tell me more. And what he was saying is that so many times people, what we do is we're so absorbed in our own selves and what we believe and what we think and our own opinions that we rarely take the time to actually enter into someone else's world to try to get their perspective, to try to get what they're feeling. And what here he is in business school basically saying, yeah, that's interesting. Tell me more. And he said, that's what he learned. You see, loving someone involves feeling what they feel, knowing what they know, asking their opinion, entering into their world. That's what incarnation is. You know, being married, and I think many of you married folks, or if you're dating, you will relate to this. In most conflicts, when marriages kind of go back and forth at each other, or any conflict really, it could be in the workplace or anything else, there are six words actually that tend to escalate conflicts in a marriage. I know I'm on the six word thing, right? What are the six words that escalate marriage conflict or even any kind of relationship conflict? And here's the six words, okay? Now, I know that all of you guys who are in relationships, when I say these six words, you're gonna be like, yep. Yep, don't say that, Drew. I can't believe you said that. But here, these six words are the words that tend to escalate relational conflicts. It's these words. You should not feel that way. Don't throw anything at me, guys. Sorry. You should not feel that way. Right? There's some times when I'm in this discussion with Tina, right? And Tina wants something different or something she wants to air on, or she wants me to wash the dishes or whatever. And I'm like, oh, I'll do it later. And she's like, no, I'd really prefer that you do it now. And she's like, you know, sometimes when you don't listen to my request, then I feel hurt by it. And I'm like, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Right? Y'all know what I'm talking about. What's next, right? It's like, what? How dare you? Right? I mean, it's one of those moments. You should not feel that way. Don't ever say that. And the reason why it escalates conflicts, the reason why, of course, is because it's basically saying you don't matter. Your feelings don't matter. Your opinions don't matter. What I think matters. But it escalates conflict because what you're basically doing is you're demeaning the other person's feelings, thoughts, opinions, their uniqueness, their personhood, their dignity. You shouldn't feel that way. You know, one of the things that my wife and I tends to be recurring conflict was, you know, and I talked to Tina, I was like, hey, is it cool that I share this? She's like, yeah, absolutely. One of the things for me is sometimes when I'm focused on something, it can be really hard to talk to me. And so if some of you guys have ever talked to me sometimes and you notice that sometimes I'm scattered, I'm like, uh-huh, yeah, uh-huh, uh-huh. And so like sometimes I'll be talking to Tina but I'll be focused. My mind will be elsewhere. Like I'll be thinking about where's Dwight Howard going to sign with? Is he going to go with the Houston Rockets or the Los Angeles Lakers? And that's all I'm thinking about, right? And so I'll just be checking ESPN.com. Just where's Dwight Howard going to go? And all of a sudden my wife will be talking to me and she'll be talking. I'll be like, And then she'll be like, Drew. I'll be like, yeah? She goes, what did I just say? I'll be like, he said all sorts of stuff. You know, and she'll be like, Drew, when you don't listen to me, I don't know if you don't care about me. Like, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. Uh-oh, right? You know how this goes. You shouldn't feel that way. And then all of a sudden, it's like it escalates the conflict. That's what normally happens. So don't ever say you should not feel that way. Now, getting to know my wife and knowing her history, what I've noticed about her was that in her family of origin, yeah, she was as the youngest child in her family. And whenever I hang out with her family, I realize where some of these wounds come from. They come from her not being, kind of her voice not mattering as much, being the youngest person. And her trying to get someone's attention and trying to tell them, hey, this is my opinion. And so when I behave that way with my wife and I say, you should not feel that way. I mean, that wouldn't bother me if I asked you these questions. Da, 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 da. What I'm basically doing is I'm dismissing her as a person. And in so doing, that's an unloving act. You see, to love someone means I'm willing to feel what they feel, to understand what it's like to be her talking to me while all I can focus on is Dwight Howard, who ended up with the Houston Rockets. Loving someone involves feeling what another person feels. See, all of us pick up on this, even as children at a young age, we pick up on this about whether or not our caretakers really care about how we feel. There's a still face experiment that we're gonna put up here, and it's a video clip of YouTube of a still face experiment. It was shown actually at our marriage seminar that we did, and this experiment is essentially, you'll see what happens in the explanation that's done by this doctor. So if we could play that right now, this baby still face experiment, that would be great.
Social interaction.
Okay, we can stop it here. What a horrible experiment, right? Some of you are like, I can't believe you showed that. I'm sure that every young parent in the room was like, do something, stop it. See, as human beings, what connects us as human beings in loving relationships is when we actually respond to the other's emotional cues, when we actually feel felt. Dr. John Van Epp, who's a Christian psychologist, he talks about emotional intensity and our development process when we're children. And when he talks about it, he has this graph or this diagram that's up that I'd like to show you. See, here's level of emotional intensity and our developmental process as children. From a young age, we have these emotional needs. And when I have these emotional needs as a child, what do I do? I do all the stuff that he was doing, right? I start screaming. As young children, that's what they do. They have emotional needs. And what happens for these young babies when they have kids, and they respond to the emotional needs of their child, it gets fulfilled. And after that gets fulfilled, a certain worldview begins to develop for children. And that development of children is basically, when I have emotional needs, those will be met by someone who understands me, by someone who's responding to me, by someone who's going to be there for me, by someone who's going to feel what I feel. That gets fulfilled, and that fulfillment leads towards growth. I begin to grow from that experience. And so my emotional intensity, it's okay. I don't have to get all worked up about things because I've grown from it. And I have a new emotional need because that's what we are as human beings. We are human beings who have emotional needs all the time. Now, this is the process that works for children as they grow up. And hopefully in your family, in my family, this is the process that we've developed with our kids or we've developed with our caretakers. But it doesn't always work this way, does it? You see, some of us, when it comes to our level of emotional intensity and our developmental process, we have these emotional needs, but those emotional needs go unfulfilled. And so what happens when a baby starts to cry because of their discomfort? Ah! And they begin to feel unfulfilled. What happens? They begin to cry louder, louder. Right? Unfulfilled. And then that emotional need is no longer just an unfulfilled emotional need. The intensity goes up so that it's not just unfulfilled, but it becomes an emotional demand. And after it becomes an emotional demand, if that doesn't get fixed, I start yelling louder and louder. If that doesn't get unfulfilled, what does it become? It becomes an emotional necessity. This isn't true just for children. It's also true for adults. Is some of us, we've grown up with certain gaps, feeling unloved. And so the reason why we tend to fall into different addictions, the reason why we fall into different patterns of behavior or conflicts with our loved ones and with our spouses and in relationships is oftentimes because we have these emotional needs that go unfulfilled and then they become emotional demands and then they go unfulfilled and they become emotional necessities. So much of our family of origin, what we experience as children, is brought into our marriages or into our relationships. And many of us, the ways that we cry, maybe we're not like children and we're like, ah, or some of us are. There are other ways that we work it out, addictions that we carry, and it's because we just got these levels of emotional intensity and we don't know what to do with it. And some of us, when it comes to our relationship with God, it's the same way. We have these emotional, and we feel like God is so absent and we just don't know what to do. You know, the reality is that no matter what family you grew up in, no matter what background that you have, every single one of us as human beings, we all have emotions. We all hurt. We all get sad. We all get angry. We all feel joy. Everyone, it doesn't matter what your background is, what your religious background is. It doesn't matter what country of origin you came from. It doesn't matter about any of these things. We're all human beings. And what it means to be a human being is that we all have these things called emotions and feelings. And some of us, we have these gaps in our lives because we've never felt. And in our relationships, what we end up doing is they become emotional necessities or emotional demands. And maybe outwardly we're grown people, but inwardly we're just like that baby crying for help and attention. And here's what Jesus is revealing so beautifully in this passage. When he actually weeps with us, what he says is, I actually love you enough that I want to show you that what it means to be a human being, a loving human being, is that I'm willing to feel what you feel. That life isn't meant to be lived in, oh, I don't kind of trust my emotions. I don't think anything about my emotions. I just focus on the truth. While that could be true to some degree, there's something missing if we don't take the time as human beings to love each other by feeling what we feel. And instead, what we say to people is, oh, you shouldn't feel that way. When Jesus reveals, no, you see, what it means to be a loving individual is actually to stop and enter into their world and take on their shoes and begin to feel what they feel. That's interesting. Tell me more. You know, one of the most beautiful things, though, about the Christian God and what's so different and so unique is none of us, if I were to take a show of hands and say, how many of you grew up in a family of origin where, you know what, every emotional need you had was fulfilled in such a loving, tender, yet firm way? I doubt any of us would raise our hands. We all have gaps. Human love is so imperfect, isn't it? Even by the very best of intentions of our best caretakers, even the best of intentions of our spouses, who sometimes we doubt whether they love us, but we've got these gaps, and honestly, it feels so hard to feel loved by them. You know what's so beautiful, though? Is that we believe in a God who weeps. He knows the final answer. He knows the truth. He's the author of all truth. We believe in a God who weeps, who understands exactly what you're going through, and who feels what you feel. There's a passage in the book of Hebrews that says this. It says, therefore, since we have a great high priest who has ascended into heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. Let's continue to trust in this God. Why? For we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize. Can I hear you say empathize? We don't have a high priest who's not able to empathize, to walk in your shoes with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. Let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. See, here's the beautiful thing about Jesus. What Jesus says is, I will be here with you, and I will actually, no matter what you're going through, no matter what ups and downs you might face in life, I want you to know that I've walked in your shoes. I've actually felt what you felt. I've gone through it. I've been a human before. Yes, I'm God, but I want you to know that I still take the time to weep with you, to show you that I love you. But not only will I weep with you, but I will actually die for you. I will die for you so that you can begin a brand new life. And I will actually be the kind of love that you've always longed for. Those emotional needs that you needed to be filled. I will be that emotional need. That I will be that person who fulfills that need. Maybe it might not be with a sudden miracle. Maybe it'll be with a long process of recovery. Maybe it'll be with a process of actually you changing one step at a time. Maybe it'll be a process of you actually joining a church and being part of a Christian community where some of your emotional needs that tend to go haywire sometimes begin to be met in healthy community. No matter what, this is what Jesus says. I will be the one whose perfect love will weep with you, but will also bring resurrection in your life, so that you can have a brand new start. So here's what I want to invite you to this morning. I'm just going to invite you to reflect on four questions, and then I'll invite you to share if you're able, and then we're going to close our service with communion. So here's what I'd like for you to do. I'm just going to ask these questions, and I just want you to either write these down. You could write it in your phone, or you could, you know, don't share it with people next to you or anything like that, but just think about it in your head. I'm going to ask you these questions and just reflect on it right now. Here's the first question. What are you mad about today? What are you mad about? Second question, what are you sad about today? What are you sad about? Third question, what are you anxious or afraid about? Anxious or afraid about? And lastly, what are you glad about? What are you glad about? Okay, what I'd like to invite you to right now, if you're willing to do this, if you prefer not to do this right now, you don't have to do it, but if you could just turn to your neighbor, and I just want you to share one thing that answers one of these questions, just one thing, okay? Now, if you're mad at the person next to you, don't use this time to tell them, all right, Matt, okay? Don't take this time to tell them. Just... But share just, hey, one thing that I'm going through. I'm going to invite the worship team to come forward as well, so...